about meditation, and then you all can take questions. I mean, you can ask questions after that. Basically, meditation is about changing the quality of the mind, improving the quality of the mind. We have to use this mind to meditate. So when we meditate, there's two things involved: the mind and the object that the mind pays attention to. Which do you think is more important, the mind or the object? He says, maybe those who haven't heard him give this little introduction. you can try this experiment with him. So if you put your hands together like this, do you know the touching sensation? Can you feel the touching sensation? And why do you know the touching sensation? And what is the mind doing that enables the mind to know the sensation? Daniel Gong. Minja Rinpoche. So he says, so although the objects for us are always there, our experiences of what we see, hear, taste, smell, or touch are always there, he says, if we're not paying attention, if we were lost in thought, we wouldn't be aware of the experiences. So what he wants to say is that the mind has to be working, the objects are already there. And so say the mind is working, it's paying attention. Then he has a second question. He says, does paying attention alone make it meditation? What do you think?
It has to be right attention.
The right attention, yeah.
Yes.
Right.
Right people do.
And so he's going to talk about what this right in right attention is.
Attention only and auto delivery.
Because attention alone doesn't make the mind meditate.
Auto delivery.
For the mind to be meditating, it has to have the right attitude, it has to have the right knowledge about what meditation is, and has to have the right view. If you were practicing, trying to practice meditation, you're paying attention to things, but there was a lot of greed on expectation for something, would you call that right meditation? Or if you were dissatisfied with what you were doing right then, or what you were experiencing right then, would that be right meditation? Or if you don't know what's going on, but you just like decide to just do anything, would that be right meditation?
Expectation,
says,
Panonishya.
He says, so the mind that practices meditation, he says, should not have greed, aversion, or delusion in it. It has to have right knowledge about how to practice meditation. And he wants to explain a little about the difference in the way the mind works when it practices two different kinds of meditation. You may have heard of one is samatha meditation or concentration meditations or tranquility meditation. The other one is vipassana, which is called insight meditation. He says, he says the goal of these two different kinds of meditation is different, and because the goal of the meditation is different, the way you practice becomes different, and the ideas that feed into the practice are different. For example, the goal of samatha meditation is calmness or concentration, whereas the goal of vipassana meditation is wisdom or insight. Why he explains this is because he says we might be practicing because we want to grow our wisdom, but we might be practicing in a way that's geared to just gaining concentration. Then wisdom doesn't arise. And he's explaining this so that we can just like check our own practice, just evaluate our own practice to find out what the mind is doing. So in samatha meditation, the object is emphasized, but in vipassana meditation, the mind is emphasized. For vipassana practice, he says, there must be wisdom in the practice, at least wisdom in the form of information. He says there's three levels of wisdom that is talked about. The first level of wisdom is like information, things that aren't your understanding, but information you get from reading or listening to other people. The second kind of wisdom is your own innate wisdom, or what you might call your intelligence. And the third kind of wisdom is insight, what comes from practice. The first two kinds of wisdom, he says, have to be applied to the practice of meditation. He says if we don't invest these two wisdoms in the practice of meditation, then the third kind of wisdom cannot come. He gives this example. If we don't know anything about a place that we're at or some work that we're doing, if we don't know anything, haven't heard anything about the place, he says then we won't really know what to do, how to get about, or how to finish that task. So we won't know what to think about the situation or what to do. He said that's why general knowledge or information is so important. We have to have, sort of boned up on that kind of knowledge either through listening to people or reading up on these things so that we have some information about what to do. He says, in the practice of vipassana meditation, he says, we want to grow wisdom. He says, so we must invest some wisdom into it. He says, and in the practice of vipassana meditation, he says, right attitude is very important. That right is very important. That's the wisdom investment. He says, without right attitude, he says, then more wisdom doesn't arise. And what is wrong practice is when there is the wrong attitudes of greed, aversion, or delusion present in the practice. He says, and for the practice of samatha meditation, the mind only pays attention to one object. But for vipassana meditation, the mind is willing to pay attention to all objects. He says, because the goal of vipassana meditation is to grow wisdom, he says, in any kind of field of knowledge, if you want to grow your wisdom or understanding about that, he says, you have to know a lot of information about that field. And it's the same if you want to grow your wisdom in practice, you have to have a lot of input about everything in your experience so that you can start to understand its nature. When we know only a few things about something, we cannot be said to know everything about that thing. And when there is incomplete knowledge, he says, you can't say that you have wisdom about that area. But in samatha meditation, because the emphasis is to pay attention to one object only, the mind doesn't try to explore anymore and know anything else. So in samatha meditation, the mind tries to stay with the object for as long as possible, so it tries to hold on to the object. There's a desire for permanence. But in vipassana meditation, he says, there's no holding on to anything. The mind is not trying to attach to any object, it's learning to let go, to just be with any object. So at this point, the practice, these two practices start diverging quite a lot. The style of practice becomes very different. So since in vipassana meditation now, the mind is not going to attach to or try to stay on one object for as long as possible. He says then it implies that the mind has to be willing to relate to all objects that come to it. So in samatha meditation, you use effort to keep the mind on the object. But in vipassana meditation, he says, it's not the kind of effort you use to keep on the object only. It's a more intelligent kind of effort, he says. It's using intelligence to do the practice. In samatha meditation, he says, it's a process of achieving a particular result, so you're creating a result for yourself. But in Vipassana meditation, he says, there's only a learning process going on. You're not trying to achieve anything. So in Samatha meditation, he says, if, for example, the mind was not calm, you would have to calm it down. Or if it was scattered, you'd have to collect the mind. But in Vipassana meditation, he says, if the mind is not calm, you don't try to calm it down. You just watch the uncalm mind. You acknowledge the uncalm mind. And you study the uncalm mind because you want to understand the nature of uncalm mind. Definition of five qualities of mind that are used when we practice meditation.
Any quality,
He says, we use these five qualities of mind when we practice meditation. They're all working together, and the practice of meditation strengthens these five qualities. So the first quality is awareness. The mind is aware. He says, awareness, as we understand it, we usually think that it means that we focus on something, use some energy to pay attention to something. He's suggesting that we don't need to use any energy to be aware. He says, if you just don't forget to know yourself, that's awareness. He says, if it's just about not forgetting yourself, does it require you to focus or use energy? Need energy? He says, if you are thinking about yourself, in those moments there is awareness. If you ask yourself, what's happening in the body? What's happening in my mind? In those moments, awareness has become present. He says, even in times when the mind is not lost in you know, useless thoughts or not lost in negative thinking or something like that, he says, and the mind is just peaceful, even in those moments, actually awareness is already present. So one of his main things that he tries to get across to yogis is not to use too much energy. Not to use too much energy. He says there is a way to practice meditation so it's not tiring and exhausting and tense. You can practice comfortably at ease in a relaxed way. He says, do you think the practice of meditation is tiring?
No.
Some yes, some. He says, if we practice meditation in the right way, it's never tiring. So if anyone finds it tiring, it's because they're maybe doing something wrong. And wrong just means that they're probably having some greed or aversion or delusion towards the practice.
Yeah.
Most of the time it's some greed towards the practice. The second quality that's working when we're meditating is called concentration. But he says concentration is just a steady mind, a stable mind, a peaceful mind.
Yes.
says, and there's two kinds of concentration. One kind of concentration you build from just paying attention to one object, and you build up the concentration of the mind. The second kind of concentration is when the mind understands something, and because it understands something, it has no reaction to it. It has the right attitude to it, or a right thought about it. It has no reaction. So aversion and greed do not arise towards just whatever is happening in the moment. And because of that, the mind is steady and relaxed, and that's a different kind of concentration. In Vipassana meditation, it's the second kind of concentration that arises. Because there's understanding, the mind is not reacting, and therefore it's steady. And he says it's only from that sort of concentration that insight arises. When we practice the kind of concentration that is sunk in the object, absorbed into the object, focused into the object, he says, then it actually weakens awareness and wisdom in the mind. Because in that sort of concentration, he says, the mind does not want to know other things, it's not trying to understand anything. All it wants to do is be calm or quiet. The third quality that we use in practice meditation is right effort. And he says right effort is not about using a lot of energy to focus or, you know, do something bodily or mentally. He says the spirit of right effort is actually perseverance or patience. When we understand the benefit of the practice and it inspires us to keep going, to keep doing it again and again, that's right effort. Quality that's working when we're meditating is called confidence, and it's confidence in yourself and in the practice that you're trying to do. He says, and how do we gain confidence in ourselves and the work that we do? He says, we have to notice the benefits that this work has for us, either intellectually, because when we've heard it, we think so, or when we're practicing, we see the benefits that are accruing to us in our lives, and that gives us confidence in the practice. We need to recognize the benefits. He says we should investigate for ourselves the practice and find out how it is benefiting us. He says that's interest in our own practice. He says, most of the time, a lot of the time when people practice, they're thinking about what they can get from the practice. But they're not really taking the time to explore and find out how to practice so that the practice will be beneficial for them. So if there is too much of a desire for results to happen, he says, then the motivation becomes greed. The way wisdom works is it investigates to see what is the best way to do this. What's happening now? How should I do it? Better. What is a more skillful means in this time, in this moment? That's using wisdom. And the last quality is the quality of wisdom in practice. He says, and the wisdom he's talking about that is brought to bear in the practice of meditation is not the high-flown wisdoms that we hear about, like deep insights and all that. It's very common wisdom, like common sense, and understanding how to practice in a skillful way. This is the kind of wisdom. He says we need to ask ourselves, do we know how to practice, and are we skillful at the practice? He says, what practice is meditation, the body or the mind? He says, if we are using the mind to practice meditation, but we don't see for ourselves how the mind uses its energy, we don't see how much energy it uses, we don't recognize the thoughts and beliefs that we hold towards the practice, we don't recognize the attitudes we're having in practice and the results of these, he says, then how can we become skillful at tuning our own practice? In fact, he says, the practice of meditation is, in the process of meditation, it's a learning of how to balance these five qualities of mind. He says, because in the moments that balance comes, he says, that's when insight arises. That's why when we practice meditation, he says, we cannot not know the mind. So he says, when we practice meditation, don't forget the mind. Don't just stay with the object. We need to understand both the object and the mind, how they work together. He says, if we don't become truly skillful, he says, it's difficult to... If we don't become truly skillful at the practice, it's difficult to grow the practice to great, to go the distance with the practice. So although we start the practice of meditation paying attention to something to bring in the to start recognizing the presence of awareness, he says we should not forget that the thing that is doing the meditation is the mind. So we start by using an object, he says, but don't forget to recognize the thing that's doing the meditation and then the attitude with which is doing the meditation. He said it slowly has to include all of this. And there's three important points that he likes, that he talks about. The first thing is the importance of continuity of awareness. Continuity or consistency is important because he says you don't have to use a lot of effort to be aware. You want to sustain the practice for as long as possible. But if you don't use a lot of energy to focus and get anything, what you will do and get from the continuity, he says, is a natural momentum. If you are consistently mindful as often as possible, with days and weeks and months, he says a momentum starts to grow, and that's a natural energy, he calls. And he says, he has said that vipassana is a learning process. So he says it's only when we constantly, continuously keep trying to do it over and over and over again, that we will learn more and more about it and become more and more skillful about with it as we understand more. He says, he says, even in other fields of study, he says, if you want to get really expert at something, he says, you have to study it for years and quite intensely. He says, in the same, well, I won't use the word intensely, in the same way, he says, if you want to really gain something from the practice of meditation, he says, you have to do it consistently and continuously and persevere. He says, right now, the way people practice meditation is, they want to practice it for a short time, put in as much energy as possible, and get the most out of that. But he would like to suggest that when we go for retreats, we should only view the retreat as a place to learn how to become skillful at using the mind to practice meditation. It's a learning how to observe the object, how to observe the mind, how to recognize the attitudes in the mind, how to work with them, and so on. And then the real practice begins when we go home and we learn to use those skills. He says, and the second important thing you want to talk about is this quality of being aware without forcing anything, without resisting anything, without trying to create something, just being aware without focusing. He says, so we'll do a practical exercise now. If you just sit as you are now, and without targeting any particular object in your body, not using the breath or the rising, falling or anything, and just notice your whole self. Can you feel the hands touching? Do you notice touching the floor or the seat of the chair? Notice the posture?
Temperature?
Sound? How much energy did it take to notice all these things? He's really trying to say, he says, that you don't need much energy at all to notice experience. He says, all we need to do is recognize ourselves and our experiences and try to maintain a continuity of that. Would that be tiring? Difficult? He says, meditation is the practice of allowing those five qualities he talked about to be present in the mind all the time. He says, it's not about the experiences that we come in contact with or the objects we choose to become aware of or become aware of. So he says you can practice comfortably, you can be relaxed while you practice, but just don't stop. So practice is like a marathon, he said. It's not like a 100-meter dash. And he says, actually, vipassana is a practice that's for the rest of your life. So since we're going to do it long term, he says, if you use too much energy, he says, you can't sustain that sort of energy output. Then you get tired easily, then you get sleepy. And then the last important point is right view. The things we'll notice when we don't forget ourselves are basically three things: either our body sensations, or our feelings, or emotions, or the mental activities. But these sensations on our bodies, the feelings or emotions we have, the mental activities that the mind does, he says, I'm not the only person experiencing these things. Everybody has the same experiences. So we can see that from this angle, that all this is not personal, it's universal. And so you can take it that all these qualities are qualities of nature. He says, if you've ever been angry before and had a thought like, I am angry, did that make you feel more angry or less angry? When we have a wrong thought or wrong view towards something, he says it makes emotions grow. If we see what is nature as nature, he says, if this right view comes in, and then we bring in awareness with that view, he says, then it's right awareness. Ordinarily, he says, our whole lives, when we think of ourselves or view ourselves, he says, the instant thought is, this is me, this is my experience, this is a habit of the mind. But if we look through the lenses of wrong view or identification, he says, we won't see nature for what it truly is. So when he says in Vipassana that we need wisdom to be present, he says we're really talking about, in the beginning, the wisdom of learned knowledge like this, just hearing the right information and trying to apply that so that we can have right view towards the practice. He says, for example, if there is pain and we think, oh, I'm in so much pain, then it just feels much more painful because of that wrong view. But for Vipassana meditation, if we can remind ourselves that pain is a quality of nature, although there's an experience of it right now, if we're not so identified with it, and then we try to be aware of it, it's much easier. And it's the same whether you look at pain or an emotion or something else that's happening in the mind. So it has, he says, it's only when we watch with right view that you can call it Vipassana, if you're watching with the wrong view, you can't say that vipassana is happening at that time. So if someone wants to practice vipassana meditation and has all this information and understands that everything is just nature, he says then for that person, nothing becomes a disturbance to the practice. Everything is nature, something to be aware of. He says, so is noise disturbing for the meditation?
Yeah.
Are thoughts disturbing to meditation? They are nature. He says, if we have this attitude towards them, then it doesn't disturb the meditation. He says, so the noise or the thoughts are never the real problem. It's if we have the wrong idea about them, the wrong understanding of them, and therefore we have the wrong attitude towards them, that makes it a problem. If we do a sitting meditation, he says, it's not really important to start with any one particular object. It doesn't have to be the breath or the rising falling or this part of the body or that part of the body. Whatever the mind notices is okay. And having recognized that, we just continue to recognize what comes next. What comes next? Anything is fine to be recognized. Because what is happening has nothing to do with you. He says, what's happening is nature. Just aware of that. We have to be careful when we are working with pain, he says, because the nature of the mind is that whenever it has contact with these experiences, all our lives we have reacted with liking and disliking. So when the mind perceives pain, its immediate reaction is usually disliking. But once there's already aversion present in the mind towards the pain, he says, and we watch that pain with that aversion in the mind, he says, we can't say that because there's aversion present in the mind, he says, you can't say that pain is the right object for the mind to observe. It's not a meditation object. So when we experience pain or other unpleasant experiences, he says the first thing we should do is check to see how the mind is feeling about that experience. How is it reacting to it? How is it relating to it? How does it feel while it's having this difficult experience? So we want to pay more attention to how the mind is feeling towards that pain rather than pay attention to the pain itself directly. He says, and in the beginning, he says, it's wise to just understand all this, have the right attitude towards the experience and try to explore this, how the mind is relating to it, to the pain, for as long as the mind is able. And then if the mind is not able, he says, to change, it's okay to, for this time, change his posture and try again next time. He says, so when we sit meditation, he says, should we move or should we not move? So he says, you know, if you should move, move. If you should not move, don't move. So should you think or should you not think? Well, don't think negative thoughts or, you know, things that you don't need to think about right now, but he says you should think about how to meditate. And when you walk meditation, or when you walk, how should you meditate? What should you observe? Notice? He's given some basic ground, right? He says when you're walking, what should you do? Walk. And what should the mind do? What should it be aware of? He says, whatever you notice about yourself. There was someone who asked the teacher him once. He said he found it sometimes difficult when doing walking meditation, like the mind was, you know, doing something else, and he found it difficult to do walking meditation. And the teacher asked him, what did he think he had to pay attention to when he was walking, when he was doing walking and trying to meditate? And the man said, yeah, he thought that he should be paying attention to his feet only. So if it was noticing some other things, he thought that he wasn't really meditating. So if we are trying to see an object of choice, if we're trying to observe something we think we should be observing, it can be difficult. But if we have no preference as to what we need to be noticing, then it's not difficult. He says, when we walk, do only the legs walk, or does it involve the whole body? Everything is walking. He says, what's important is for the awareness to be present. He says, mindfulness meditation is about cultivating the mindfulness, the awareness, yeah? You can start with any object. And if you've been trying to be mindful continuously, and the mindfulness actually gets established, and he says you not only will notice body sensations, you also notice states of mind, feelings, and so on. Okay, he's finished talking. He says, you can ask questions.
Let's say we're walking and there's mind objects come up. How much permission do we have to reflect on why these things are arising? Because I mentioned saying, what did you learn from your meditation?
What?
Gives permission to do a lot of reflecting. Maybe.
Mind object for line. Bajam dari for la le lo me bo balatin le re bapilo lesro. Uzia me re banale di lesro. Aso yam yai senza bo kuye pe de lo pita bo.
Senza kaina mo, senza la adjitio.
하고 나무 앞에 꼭 공이 연동하고 가만히들 필요해서 그에 살펴보는 말로 꼭지하고
He says investigation is like a question to give a sense of investigation is only to help the observation to be more directed, like, you know, it gives a sense of purpose to the observation. And he says, one question is enough, and after that, do a lot of observing, not to think continuously. He's not saying to think about these things. He's saying think a little bit, which helps the practice. And in fact, he says, when he says think, he's really talking about people who just tend to do practice in a very kind of like they're just very concentrated and quiet and their mind is not very agile. But he says, for people whose minds are naturally curious and active and investigative, he says these people don't even need to ask questions. They can just do the practice in a steady way, and the mind will ask the questions when it needs to because the mind is already naturally curious and has that sort of nature. He says, like scientists, you know, they have a question in mind, they have a theory they want to prove or whatever, and what they do after that is they do a lot of experiments, they study things in great detail. Yeah, what is happening needs to come first for a long time before.
Does understanding come from just observing, or are we supposed to bring more than just the observation?
Yeah, na chi yong ne la la mo hoi chi yong na te po la ya ma. He says there has to be the intention to understand and then a sense of investigation. And with these two kind of attitudes in the mind just then observes continuously or in detail. It's just interested to know whatever it can. He says, when the mind has gathered enough data, and it, you know, because the mind holds its intention in the back of the mind, he says, when it has enough data, the mind will understand things, the understanding will come from the mind at that point. It's like watching a movie, he says. When the movie begins, we don't really know what's going on. But if you watch the whole show and it unfolds at the end of the thing, you kind of understand the point of it all. So it's only when we see everything that's happened in the whole process that we understand.
What rule do you see for metta practice or regular practice, like
metta? Helps to calm the mind, give it some peace. But if you practice some metta and it's helped to calm the mind down and the mind is feeling peaceful, he said then use that point, that state to then push the mind to investigate more and gain more wisdom. He says, what do we want to do when we have peace and calmness already? Just indulge in it?
Mm-hmm.
always ask this question. Do you want to wallow in it, or you want to investigate it, understand it? He says, if we just indulge in something, just wallow in it, enjoy it, he says, it'll feel good, but we won't grow in wisdom. Yeah, grow wiser. So we really need to remember, what is our objective? What do we really want from the practice?
Can we go back to walking for a minute? This weekend I tried walking without anger. Didn't get too far. In the sense
you didn't get too far?
Yeah. It was raining, and it was windy, and there were a lot of sounds. And my mind just went from item to item, and I didn't feel like I didn't become steady whatsoever. So my practice had been a 5-point or 9-point walking. And then eventually, after I root in that anchor, sometimes I can go a little bit, I can follow from there. I have to become steady first.
So when you do 5 and 9 point walking, are you doing it very slowly?
Yes.
He says, when you don't become rooted and calm or whatever, he said, what's wrong with that? He says, yeah, preference. Yeah, he says, we're so used to getting calm or concentrated, it's like we don't know what to do without it. He says, can't you just recognize it's not calm?
So, the guidance.
You can take not being calm as an object and keep recognizing that. Still not calm. It's still not calm. It's still not calm. He says, you know, when we go for calmness as an objective, he says, then we want to be calm. If it's calm, we're attached to it. We think that's the way. If it's not calm, we don't like it. We don't know what to do.
So the guidance is to proceed without an anchor, or to give it a whirl.
He says he's not saying you cannot have an anchor. It's not that you cannot have one object that you like to go back to. It's just he's saying don't get attached to it. So if the mind goes to something else, it's okay too. And he really wants to point out whether you keep one object as an anchor and pay attention to it continuously, or you have many objects and you have the right attitude and you pay attention to them continuously, what brings steadiness to the mind is that continuously, not the object that the mind is paying attention to, or the objects that the mind is paying attention to. He says, when you say that the mind doesn't become steady, he says, do you say that because there are many objects that the mind is able to perceive and therefore you think it's not steady? Or does it really feel unsteady in the mind, like you feel all agitated and...
So, speaking back to Sunday when I was walking, there are so many objects that I think because of that,
Any other, I am yellow to agitate a little bit.
I
get like that, he says, instead of noticing all those many objects, just take that agitation as your object. Just look inside of the agitation and just keep watching the agitation. Whenever any experience of one object or many objects or some object brings agitation or unsettledness to the mind, liking or disliking to the mind, he says, pay attention to that in the mind first. He says, it's easy to say, well, just look at this object. And of course it'll calm your mind down. He says, but, he says, then we just kind of stuck there, staying with one object and being calm and not moving anywhere from that. And then, he says, we also kind of become crippled, because it's like if there are many objects, then we don't know what to do, and we also don't like it. So there's all this reactivity at other times. So if, you know, having many objects makes the mind feel uncomfortable or unsettled, he said it's a sure sign that the mind has been liking something before and is attached and has been attached to something else before. But he says when we meditate, is all this attachment and aversion and all supposed to become less or more? What?
I know what I prefer.
What do you prefer? What to put out of the He says, liking samadhi, liking concentration, attachment to concentration, and attachment to that high when we take drugs or something. He said, what's the difference? Identification that's happened is not you. So what is your point of view towards the experience that you're having now? That right thought needs to come in first.
So this whole idea of wholesome and unwholesome that I heard a lot about in Buddhist practice, it's a little counterproductive to what you're saying. I mean, because wholesome or unwholesome doesn't matter.
He says, it's not that it's not important, but the practice is to understand what is a wholesome mind, what is an unwholesome mind, to really know for yourself. Whose mind is the wholesome mind? Whose mind is the unwholesome mind?
mind?
Is it your mind? He says, because you want to really know that for yourself. That's why you're going to look at it. And even wholesome and unwholesome mind, he says, the Buddha said, on some experience, yeah? If we have the right thought towards the experience, that is the now wholesome mind. If we have the wrong thought towards the experience, that is now the unwholesome thought mind. Yeah. Now you want to understand nature as it is. That's why you're going to look at it as it is. He says, and the purpose of calming the mind down, the mind or the body down, in the practice you've known before, is also to enable you to actually observe. He says, if you use the right thought, like recognizing that, okay, this is not me, this is the nature of this emotion, let's look at it. He said that also, if that right thought works for you, he said, it also calms the mind down. He says, after which you have to use that calmer mind to observe. Now, if you try using this kind of right thought and you find it doesn't work, it's not helping the mind to calm down, he says, then you can use that other practice. Bring it back. Calm the mind down. But then observe. He says, a wholesome or an unwholesome mind. He says, why does a wholesome mind arise? Or why does an unwholesome mind arise? And what is this wholesome or unwholesome mind? And then you also want to see, why does a wholesome mind increase? Or why does an unwholesome mind grow? Or why does a wholesome mind decrease, fade away? Why does an unwholesome mind fade away? You're researching this. If no questions, we can. Okay.
What about intuition?
Sorry?
What about intuition?
What do you mean by intuition?
By intuition, I'm trying to suggest an attitude that isn't caught up in trying to do it the right way, that isn't as cerebral and isn't trying to check oneself necessarily, but allow for some spontaneity and for me it's important, so I guess I'm asking if it is important in this practice.
Can I use the word feeling your way through something? Something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Intuition's right. Spontaneous.
He says that's important. It's necessary. He said that's natural intelligence. It's using our innate intelligence. He says, where do you think that intuition comes from?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I agree. I think that intuition is the natural mind at work without being created by me.
Actually, there are many experiences and episodes in our life that feeds into our intuition. says, so people whose mindfulness is very continuous, their intuition is very strong. At home, really, like daily. He says, then it becomes really interesting. You really see. Then you have so many things to ask him. He said. Yeah. He says city centers, you know, where people don't have time to go to retreat, and people are trying so desperately to practice in daily life because that's their only retreat. And he says, that's what happens. That's a real love. He says, if you're really trying to practice and you ask him questions and you discuss these these questions with him, he says there's real life to it. That's much more interesting and more real for you too. If you've really been doing something, you can really understand. In when he went to Korea, he didn't have a retreat center to which people came to stay. People just came one day, got instructions from him. And then the rest of his stay, they went to work every day, they stayed at home, had their relationships with all the family and friends and all that. And every day in the evening, or he had times that they could come and see him, they would come and talk to him about how they were trying to do all the things that he was saying. And there were some people, it made a big difference to their lives.